Let's return to the Garden of Gethsemane on the western side of the slope of the Mount of Olives, where Jesus has been in the custom of stopping and spending time with his apostles on his way back to the city of Bethany, where he was staying at the house of Simon the former leper and Martha. In this garden, Jesus had left eight of his apostles somewhere near the gate, then taken his three inner circle, Peter, James, and John, farther into the garden, and instructed them that they should pray with him, that his heart was heavy, that he was weighted down with things that were about to occur, and he needed them to pray and watch with him, and that they needed to pray they wouldn't fall into temptation. He went away from them once and prayed, "Father, let this cup pass from me, but if not, your will be done." He came back, found them sleeping, and chided them over it. Went away a second time, prayed the exact same things. Came back, found them sleeping again, chided them over it. They were embarrassed. But their eyes were so heavy, they weren't sure how to respond to his insistence that they stay awake. It's probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, something in that neighborhood, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And so Jesus goes away the third time. Now, at this point, I'd like us to draw in something from Luke chapter 22 that is not found anywhere else in the Gospels. First, let's do the summary of what Jesus was saying on his third time of prayer. Luke 22:42, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me," meaning death on the cross, death by the placing of all the sin of the world upon his shoulders in a moment of time. "Let that pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." Verse 43 is unique to Luke's gospel. "And there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him." We actually saw something similar to this happen during the temptation, that after Jesus had spent 40 days and 40 nights being tempted, being by himself in the wilderness, fasting, that angels were dispatched to minister to him, to encourage him, to support him. So that appears to be what occurs at this juncture. Then verse 44, again, unique. "Being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground." Now there is a condition that has entered into the medical textbooks, where if you are under intense stress and your blood pressure spikes out, that the capillaries in your skin can burst open and some of that blood material can get into the sweat glands and you actually bleed through your sweat glands. You sweat blood. And so this may in fact be an indicator of Jesus extreme stress at this moment, that he was sweating blood. And then verse 45, "When he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, 'Why are you sleeping? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation.'" The other two gospels that we've been looking at heavily, Matthew and Mark, said that this was the moment at which he told them that they'll have to get their sleep later because the time has come. The Son of Man's being betrayed into the hands of sinners. You need to get up off the ground, and we're going to go out here because my betrayer has arrived. Luke actually says at this point, while he was still speaking, there came a crowd, and the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. So Judas has caught up with Jesus with this arrest party, which, remember, I told you last time is not a Roman contingent. The Romans will come into this story later. This is all Jewish at this stage. This is a contingent made up of the temple security forces. The temple needed lots of police in order to keep the peace of people coming in and out of the temple complex. And so a fairly decent group of those temple police have been handed over into the leadership of Judas. We know that from John chapter 18, verse 3. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there, that is, to the Garden of Gethsemane, with lanterns and torches and weapons. So this is an armed arrest party. Matthew puts it this way, Matthew 26, 47. While he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. So this group it does have swords, but the swords are not their weapon of choice for an arrest. That's the club part, like a little billy club or a nightstick. That's what they plan on using in order to take Jesus into custody. And remember, the whole plan was to take him into custody away from the crowds. John chapter 18, verse number 4. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" So we have to get this picture in our heads that this arrest party, led by Judas, arrives at the front gate of the Garden of Gethsemane, comes right through the front gate, comes by the first 8 apostles that have been waiting there, probably asleep, pushes into the garden farther. Jesus and his 3 innermost circle are approaching now this arrest party. And Jesus himself speaks up out of the darkness. There are torches, yes. There is moonlight, no doubt. But Jesus is in the darkness of the night enough that he can't be immediately recognized. And so he asks them out of the darkness, "Whom are you seeking? Who are you looking for?" And they answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said to them, and this is unique to John, and I love it. He said to them, "I am." And John really emphasizes this two-word phrase of Jesus that echoes Exodus chapter 3, where Moses had asked the question of God, "I'm going to go to the Israelis, and they're going to ask me which God I'm representing. What God should I tell them?" And God's response was, "I am whom I am. Tell them that I am sent you." And so Jesus is grabbing a hold of the divine name here from Exodus chapter 3. And the moment he spoke that out loud, something miraculous happens. Now Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. So he's right there in the arrest party, right at the forefront of it. Verse 6, John's testimony, John the Apostle, right there, saw this happen. When Jesus said to them, "I am," they drew back and fell to the ground. So they actually were pushed backwards from Jesus, and they lost their footing. They got down on the ground because of that. Now, that push by the divine name, by the presence of God in human form, was a bit of a shot across the bow to these guys. It was a bit of a warning to them that they need to proceed carefully with what happens next. Because listen to what Jesus said thereafter. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" So he's effectively saying, your arrest order. Who's it for? Give me the name. And they said, Jesus, or Jesus, Yehoshua, of Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth. And so Jesus answered, well, I told you I am. So if you seek me, let these men go. So Jesus is effectively saying, your arrest warrant is for me, not for any of these guys. You need to back off and let them go. And he's used the force of his name to kind of give them a good reason why they should follow that instruction. John gives this commentary. This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have not lost one. Jesus had prayed those words, remember, in chapter number 17. So Jesus has just opened the door for his 11 apostles to be able to get out of the garden without being arrested along with him. Now, we have to pull in from another place here. This is from Matthew 26:48. Now, the betrayer had given them a sign saying, the one I will kiss is the man, seize him. So the arrest party is now at this point, having been knocked backward, a little bit off kilter, not sure how to proceed. And so somebody has identified themselves of Jesus as Jesus of Nazareth, but what if that's a ploy? So Judas gives them this signal. I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to greet one of them with a traditional kiss. He's the one. You grab him, tie him up. So he came up to Jesus at once and said, greetings, Rabbi. Greetings, Rabbi. And he kissed him. Now, Jesus says basically two things to him here. And it's recorded in two different passages. This is from Luke 22:48. Jesus said back to him, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? So that's Jesus' way of saying, really, you are going to betray me by acting as my friend, as my confidant. And then the Matthew 26:50 passage says that he said to him, well, friend, and it's the word of for a companion, do what you came to do. So basically, just get it over with. And then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. Now, Luke 22:49 says it this way. When those who were around him saw what would follow. So now they've seen the betrayal of Judas, and the arrest party moves forward and grabs Jesus by the arms, and they proceed to start tying him up. They said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Now that has to be, in my mind, John. Remember that in the discussion in the upper room, Jesus had told them, any of you that hasn't got a sword, you need to sell some belongings and go out and buy one. Because they're going to be needing this utility tool as they take the gospel into the world. Remember, the word for sword can also be a big butcher knife. In response to Jesus' words, they had said to him in the upper room, Lord, here's two swords, or here's two butcher knives. And the most reasonable way to understand that is that these are the two big butcher knives that were used by Peter and John to prepare the Passover meal that night. They would have been the blades they used to cut the throats of the animals before they skinned them out and then roasted them. And then they would have been the blades that they used to cut off pieces of the roasted lamb during the Passover meal. So it is reasonable to assume that the two men in this garden that are armed with these big butcher knives, these two swords, are Peter and John. And we're already looking toward the knowledge that Peter's going to use his. But John must have asked the question first because he's uncertain. What am I supposed to do? They're arresting Jesus right here in front of me. And so he asked the question, but Peter doesn't bother to ask for permission. All four Gospels tell us that he stretched out his hand, drew his sword, or pulled out his big butcher knife, and he struck off the high priest's servant's right ear. Very specific, isn't it? John chapter 18 even gives us a little bit more detail. This is John 18, 10. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Now, I am curious, in John telling that story, does that mean that Malchus may have later become a follower of Jesus Christ and was therefore known to those who might be reading John's gospel? I certainly hope that that is the case, but we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? Now, when it says it struck off his right ear, assuming that Peter is right-handed, which the majority of people are, the guy must have ducked a blow that was intended to take his head off, or at least take his throat out. So Peter is following through with exactly what he said in the upper room, that he would stick with Jesus to the bitter end. He would die before he abandoned Jesus. But he is acting on behalf of his own misunderstanding of what Jesus came here to do. Matthew chapter 26, verse number 52. Then Jesus said to him, that is to Peter, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword shall perish by the sword." So Peter, knock it off with the assaulting people with the sword, trying to kill people with that sword, because if that's the tack you take, then you will die by the sword yourself. Then verse 53, this is the correction of his misunderstanding. "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels?" Now, a full-strength Roman legion is about 6,000 fighting soldiers. But that is reinforced further by all sorts of support personnel and engineers that could run the siege equipment. And then you've got the cavalry that's attached to it. So 12,000 legion soldiers is a lot more than 72,000. We are talking about well over 150,000 personnel that would be involved in something like that. And he's not even talking about human beings. Jesus says that he could get 12 legions of angels. Every angel could kill hundreds of thousands of people overnight. We have that evidence from the Old Testament. So this large number of angels could wipe out the entire world in a matter of moments. And so Jesus is effectively telling Peter, "I don't need your assistance, Peter. If I really wanted out of this, then I'd talk to the Father and he would instantly put a stop to all this." But all of this has to take place. That's what Jesus wants him to know. Peter is told by him, Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Does that language sound familiar? He was just praying shortly before this, Father, if possible, let this cup pass from me, but if not, your will be done. So Jesus tells Peter, this needs to happen. You need to back off. Put that sword back where it came from. Now, this is all taking place in a matter of seconds here. And there's a guy bleeding. He's lost part of his ear. And so Jesus wants to fix that before it can cause problems. Verse 51 of Luke 22 says, Jesus said, no more of this. Now, that's our English Standard Version translation. I had a Bible professor in my undergraduate training that said that he liked an alternate translation from the Greek here that I happen to agree with him on, that the literalness here is permit this much. And so I think Jesus more than likely had already been grabbed on both arms by the arrest party, and so he's asking permission for them to let him go for a moment so that he could do this. He touched his ear and healed him. So right there in front of everybody, Jesus fixes the problem of the assault victim, the man that Peter had tried to kill but only took his ear off. Now, why is it important? Because Peter is now not guilty of doing anything because the problem has been fixed. And so Jesus is trying to ensure that not a single one of the 11 will get taken away with him. He wants them left free. Luke goes on at this point, Luke 22:52, where Jesus turns his attention to the arrest party. Matthew and Mark both have this same sort of information. Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple, see, that's the security police force out of the temple. These are all Jewish guys. There's not a Roman among them. Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and the elders who had come out against him, have you come out as against a robber? A robber is a thief by force. A mugger, for example, is somebody that we term as a robber. Somebody that would punch you in the face or knock you over the head and take your stuff. So Jesus said, so what? Are you coming out here as if I'm the thug? I'm the bad guy? And you're bringing your swords and your clubs? Verse 53, when I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. So he chides them with the fact that they didn't do the arrest in the public. They're doing this all undercover, all covertly. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. And so at that point, John 18:12 says, so the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. So it's all over with now. Jesus has been grabbed. He is being tied up. He is not trying to defend himself. He got after Peter for trying to defend him. And so the apostles realize there is nothing they can do. And so what does Matthew and Mark report? It says, then all the disciples left him and fled. They started running out into the woods, running out of the garden and into the night, exactly as Jesus told them they would. This night, all of you will abandon me. That's what Jesus predicted. And now that's come to pass. Now, as we close up today, I want to include Mark 15:51-52. Only Mark tells this story. And because of that, some people have suggested that maybe this is Mark's story, that this is all about what happened to him that night. And my response to that is highly unlikely. John Mark seems to be a young man in the gospel, or excuse me, in the book of Acts later, like as in a decade or so after all of these events. He couldn't have been much more than a baby when these events took place in the Garden of Gethsemane. So I don't think it's Mark. I'm going to give you my suggestion in just a moment. Let's read the story first. There was a young man who followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. So this guy was not dressed in normal clothes. He just simply had his underwear on, pretty much. That's what we'd call it. And then he had this cloth wrapped around him. Well, when the apostles ran off into the night, apparently the arrest party started thinking maybe they should grab these people. And there was this guy right there. And so they seized him. They grabbed at him. But he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Now, not Jaybird naked, not stark naked, but he didn't have proper clothing on. So he was not properly attired. Who is this guy? Nobody knows for sure, but I'm going to suggest something to you that I've suggested before. Do you remember the rich young ruler? How Jesus had told him that if he really wanted to be complete, he needed to sell everything that he had and then come follow him. But he went away because he was so wealthy. He was sad by this idea that he'd have to give everything up in order to become a follower of Jesus. I would love it if this is the rest of his story, that at some point after his encounter with Jesus, he rethought everything and decided, yes, I need to follow through with that. And that he went and sold everything, including the clothes off his back, and then was following Jesus right up to the Garden of Gethsemane and was there the night that he was arrested. Wouldn't that be a great part of the story? But I guess in reality, we'll all have to wait until we're in eternity. And then, whoever this is, will be identified. Come back tomorrow for more of God's Word.